Buddhist Summer School, 1976. Let us talk, given on Tuesday afternoon, the 31st of August.
The eternity of life holds within itself the deathful and the deathless. Whence comes the differentiation between the two? Where does it lie? Does it lie in the real nature of things? I would say not. Surely this differentiation lies in our own mode of awareness. If and when we are unable to be still and silent within, in the true and deep sense, the complete sense, then we are conscious in terms of limitation and of discrimination. Our consciousness, vijnana in the Buddhist sense specifically, is a discriminative consciousness. A consciousness which separates things out. And when this consciousness comes to the end point of its cognition of that which it is cognizing, there is what we call death. We don't quite understand how to be purely attentive, wholly mindful. If we were wholly mindful and purely attentive, then this living awareness would not experience a cessation. And if it does not experience a cessation, but is in continual rhythm with the ceaseless creative pulse of life, nothing in our awareness undergoes death. It only undergoes total transformation in line with the transforming process, the becoming process, the changefulness of things. But because we are not like that, therefore we see the universal process as a one of being born, proceeding and dying. The deathless is not a full stop, not a static condition. The deathless is as intensely alive as the death soul which we experience here and now. The deathless represents the fact that our awareness remains continuously through time in perfect rhythm with the changing process. In rhythm, in tune. Therefore, the interpretation by our own mind is one in which there is no gap between the immortality of reality and our awareness of the process. To put it in another form, time, the time sense, is an expression of the fact that our mode of awareness is out of rhythm, out of tune with the becoming process. So we experience breaks, disharmonies, and we call them being born, proceeding, and dying. If such a break didn't occur, then we would be aware in the mode of immortality, of not dying, of the undying. And if we are aware in the mode of the undying, then the sharp point of birth would also disappear. Beginning. Time, the time consciousness, the time sense, gives place to the living in timelessness. Here we see one of the deep points involved in the practice of samadhi. We think of meditation as concentration, of fixing the mind on a particular subject or something like that. It is, of course, perfectly possible to fix the mind on something. But if we fix the mind, the attention, that means, in this manner, we are excluding the reception of stimuli from all the other aspects of the becoming process in the situation in which we are placed. Therefore, there is a separation, a cutting off. We are cut off from the total reality. But if we are truly still and silent, that stillness and silence will include all the movement and activity and turmoil which goes around, and also it will be centered, it will be established in that supreme ocean of existence which is peaceful, timeless, birthless and deathless, not mortal. And if the time sense gives way, through perfect attentiveness, through perfect mindfulness, to this sense of the timeless, then fear and sorrow disappear with the disappearance of this time sense, because of which we know birth and death. what is it that prevents, or at least what is one of the important things that prevents us from being aware, awake, in this utterly open and free manner? It is our collection of mental constructs, our thoughts, conceptions, all fixed ideas, doctrines, dogmas, and so forth. All these belong to the realm of the known, and the known belongs to the past. We call it the dead past. The present moment is the resultant of the countless millions of forces which operated through the past to bring us to this present point. The present point is the living manifestation of the dead past. If attention can be totally in the living present, utterly open, utterly free, unobstructed by anything that clutters the mind, then all that dead past is fully alive in the immediate now. And in that sense, one knows infinity. One knows the timeless. Not knows in terms of a collection of ideas or thoughts, remember. When that happens, the thinking process, as you and I ordinarily experience it, has stopped. There is no chatter consisting of a flow of words going on in the brain. The brain is utterly silent, and the mind is wholly active. This is the extraordinary part of it. But it is active with an activity of which we can form no conception, no limitation whatsoever. No form, no shape. Any conception that we form in the ordinary way is an image which distorts the actual reality. Therefore, all our perceptions are never true perceptions. They are never true thoughts in that profound creative sense in which we talked of thought yesterday. What is the fundamental meaning implied in this word conception? Living beings like you and I come into the world and we say that our starting point is a conception. What is this conception? It consists of an interactivity between positive and negative, male and female, which results in a new life, a new individual life, that is conception. Now, the universe comes into being through conception. when this creative activity, this creative action in eternity of the creative power, which is the great mystery, the unknown, suddenly upsurges, and after the upsurge, it tends to fall back on itself. You see similar phenomena throughout nature. It tends to fall back upon itself, and in that falling back upon itself, it limits itself. This is what I meant by using the term self-constriction the other day. It limits itself, and in that limited selfness, it is the container of the unlimited creative energy which upsurged. That's how the first is a bad word, but still we'll have to use it. First conception in the mind of the creative power of the universe. The logos of various religions, the word, the logos is this conception in the mind of God, as it is said. In Buddhistic terms, we leave out the word God, we keep the term mind, pure mind. It's a creative power, creative activity. It's upsurge, and falling back upon itself makes its own container. And in the making of its own container, it has produced something which is limited and confined. Evolution takes place in this. There is no such thing as evolution for the ultimate creative power. No such thing at all. So now, in the life of beings, you and I, something similar to this takes place through the instrumentality of our brains and nervous system and our sense functioning and so forth. And these are our thoughts, as we call them. But all thoughts are something which belonged to the past. The immediate living event which sends out the stimulus or stimuli which give rise to thought is unknown. It is the creative immediate now which remains unknown. A fraction of a second later, or maybe quite a long time afterwards, the seeing subject looking back upon it as an object raises up a form in the brain, a thought form. These thought forms are our thoughts. Now these are the things which the mind throws out of itself. But this is what we cling to. Each one of us, having thought, should let go the thought completely and attend to the immediate now. Keep attention fixed on the immediate now. The thought which we throw out, either by writing or by speaking or by silent telepathic or other influence, may be useful for another, may be a stimulus when it touches another mind. So our thoughts are not useless. They are excrescences as far as we ourselves are concerned, but they may be valuable nourishment for someone else. But we tend to cling. We set it down in writing, the creed is fixed, and we all are conditioned to repeat it, paraphrase, and think that we are now living the religious life, having mumbled through the words. Then when we start, as we say, thinking about those words, we are just churning them round in accord with our already conditioned mind. So there is no real growth that way. If we let the mind be quiet and just direct attention with the quiet mind to those words, the words of the creed and the doctrines and the dogmas and so on, if the mind itself is quiet and the brain stops chattering back at those words, then an activity takes place in the depths of the mind which raises up some sort of valuable conception for us in the immediate moment. And this way, intelligence, the power to see truly into things, grows. And that's how one comes to know things better and better. There comes the point when that no longer is necessary, because coupled with the purification of the mind, what we call our mind becomes utterly emptied, which means that it becomes completely transparent. The mind is like an energy. It is an energy which throbs in harmony with the universal mind. When Theravada presents Nama Rupa, what it is presenting actually, in the complete sense, is mentality, corporeality. And mentality, corporeality are universal. They are not yours or mine. But they manifest as yours or mine insofar as we as living organisms confined to a bodily existence produce particular thoughts and particular actions, physical actions. So there comes the point when this energy, this pure energy, unsullied energy, is mind, which is mind in us, is utterly emptied. The whole mind is clean and pure, then it is the universal mind that functions through that individual. Then the words which he says are words which are significant. They are a power, a real power, to help the environment and all who come within that environment. Then that person can produce a true perception. That person can produce a true perception, because by that time the sense of separate I, the I-hood, has completely vanished, it has completely dissolved. And in its dissolution, the limited person, the limited personality, is replaced by the universal reality. These things are not easy to understand. I don't say grasp, because you grasp at a thought, at a concept. But to understand really means to be so empty and so open that you, the person, have become that which is understood. So they said of the Buddha, he is the Dhamma becoming. Who sees me sees Dhamma. Who sees Dhamma sees me. But what sort of a me is this? Not just Siddhartha Gautama Esquire, but Siddhartha Gautama, in whom is embodied the totality which is the universe, the reality which cannot be spoken of. He is the Tathagata gone thus, the deep, the unfathomable, the trackless. He cannot be traced. The word he doesn't apply to him anymore. Excepting for convenience in distinguishing the body which everybody called Gautama from the body which everybody called Ananda or Kashyapa or Subhuti or whoever it was. So now look at it another way again. This mind, which is our mind at the moment, is, despite its deficiencies, the only mind we have, which, if rightly utilized, can become the vessel, the grail, if you like, of transcendence. That is why it was said, before the days of the Buddha, in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, for instance, verily, while we are here, we may know this. If you have known it not, great is the destruction. Destruction in terms of sorrow for oneself and for those around one. Destruction in terms of the non-fulfillment of one's own true destiny. To be the vehicle, the apparatus through which the energies of transcendence function freely. The deathless shines through the deathful, as we may say. Those who know this, know it not as thoughts and concepts, please, remember, know it in the deep sense of knowing by becoming it, as I've tried to explain, but it's very difficult. Those who know this become immortal, but others go only to sorrow. Put it in another form, those who know this are freed of the time sense, and therefore of the lag, the time lag, so to say, in awareness with the becoming process. We are out of step with it. But so this becoming immortal means essentially the mode in which you are aware. Because no body ever becomes immortal in the common dictionary sense of the word, to live forever and ever. That is a time-bound concept. And it's a worthless concept. That is why the heavens and hells in perpetuity are rather ridiculous caricatures of what is reality. Now, another statement, that is the statement which is of great importance, while we are here, we may know this. Not in any hereafter. Because you as you, who are an integrated pattern of the skandhas, disappear completely when any aspect of the skandhas has vanished. Rupa, Vedna, Sanya, Sankhara, Vijnana, they are all completely interdependent. Take out one and the lot disintegrate. And because the lot are there together in integration, the I am I sense, which is a misperception of our true nature, exists for the time being, and that I am I sense comes into being after you are born, not before. That identity which you, this I am I concept, is the entity which is you. Not a real entity, it's an imaginary entity. And that imaginary entity depends upon the fact that there is this integration of the skandhas. And whilst it holds, that I am I consciousness holds good. And it belongs to the body which bears a particular name and is recognized by that name and experienced as such by those around throughout a person's life. When that any one element disappears, the whole thing completely disappears as such. So, you as you have no hereafter. If awareness is transformed from the time mode of awareness into the timeless, and through the becoming process, you are alive, you are awake in terms of immortality, then the awareness which is our particular vijnana does not survive at all. But the reality is neither diminished nor is it expanded. Totality remains totality, eternal, immortal, call it what you like. That never changes. And it is totality which reaps everything that you have thought, felt, done, etc. during your lifetime. Terrible doctrine, believe me. Use it, if you are capable of using it. Let the doctrine go. Remain awake. And if you remain awake after letting this doctrine go, immortality will shine through your existence. And thereby you are fulfilling one, at least, of the great purposes of your individual existence as such. Yajnavalkya, in another discourse which he gives to his wife, says quite openly, after death there is no consciousness. All the elements have gone. Transcendence remains transcendence. There is no annihilation, therefore. But there is no perpetuity of a separate, self-conscious, isolated, identifiable entity. It is this identifiability that is the crux of the matter. That's why we talk in terms of attaining this, reaching nirvana, the person realizing nirvana, or he has gone to heaven, or anything like that. These are all the thoughts of men, not the conception of the creative power, the true conception. These are all false conception, perceptions, no perceptions, as the Vajracchedika Prajna Paramita puts it. No true perceptions. But the true perception, the true conception, comes when you are functioning in the mode of immortality. And then a little later, the same Upanishad says, by the mind alone is it to be perceived. There is on earth no diversity. He gets death after death who perceives here seeming diversity. As a unity only is it to be looked upon, this indemonstrable, enduring being, spotless, beyond space, the unborn Atma, great, enduring. By knowing it only, a wise Brahman should get for himself intelligence. He should not meditate upon many words, for that is a weariness of speech. By the mind alone is it to be perceived. So you see, this mind, imperfect as it is, impure as it is after all the only instrument we have by means of which we can open out, become awake. So now, let us just bear in mind the known and thoughts and so forth do not take us, do not conduce to our real inward growth. It is this mysterious process of growing through pure mindfulness, through complete attentiveness, chit, which is the essential thing. If you are inattentive at any moment, then you slide back. As I said yesterday, I think, the moment of forgetfulness is the devil's joy. That is the time he catches you and trips you up. Now, having said that, see what Hui Neng says. Hui Neng, as he was traveling, was pursued by a gang of bad youths, very much after the modern fashion. And one of them came along and shouted to him, "Lay brother, lay brother, I come for the Dharma, not for the robe." And Hui Neng had hidden himself, being chased by all these rather awful creatures. Whereupon I came out from my hiding place and squatted on the rock. He made obeisance and said, "Lay brother, preach to me, please. Since the object of your coming is the Dharma," said I, "refrain from thinking of anything and keep your mind blank." I think blank is not quite the happiest word in that context. Keep your mind quiet, peaceful, sensitive, open. Keep it blank. The word blank sort of brings up the association of don't let anything come in or emerge out of it. Not that. Keep it open, but peaceful, quiet. "I will then teach you." When he had done this for a considerable time, note, for a considerable time, I said, "When you are thinking of neither good nor evil, what is at that particular moment, venerable sir, your real nature?" Now, you see, what is hid in that? When you are thinking of neither good nor evil, The meaning surely is, or at least one of the meanings surely is, that as you think, you are not discriminating that this is evil as against that which is good. If it is evil, you just see it is evil. If it is good, you just see that it is good. So you are not caught up, you are not attached or averse from the good or the evil. You have gone beyond good and evil, which means that your own mind is so purified, so transparent, that all the duality is resolved into a transcendent unity in your own being, in your own awareness. And in that state, you yourself are the instrument of transmutation of both the good and the evil into the absolute, well, there are no words in the language, so I have to say good. See, that's what happens. It's not a state of indifference, because in that state, the creative power, this unknown, mysterious creative power, is at work and transmutes whatsoever comes in into the perfect thing, as far as the perfect thing can ever be brought into being through a human being. So, when you are thinking of neither good nor evil, what is, at that particular moment, your real nature? And within brackets, the editor has put, literally, original face. What is your original face? In your original face, it's the face of the transcendent. Or if you like to use that beautiful Kabbalistic term, the face of the Ancient of Days. As soon as he heard this, he at once became enlightened. Now you see why I mentioned yesterday that the word enlightened is used in a slightly different sense from the word enlightenment. In Zen, it is used in a slightly different sense from Mahayana and Theravada. He at once became enlightened. But remember, this step came with violence and anger. Do you think that that mind in that particular psychophysical organism was completely and utterly purified as such, miraculously? It's not impossible, admittedly, but it is extremely unlikely. We have a corresponding example in Palestine. Mary Magdalene comes to see Jesus. With what intent does she come? But what happens? In the presence of the Holy One, she is baptized with the fire of the Spirit, which burnt out all evil-mindedness or evil-heartedness in her. And she becomes one of the true and great apostles of Jesus. She was present at the crucifixion when several of the others had fled out of fear. As soon as he heard this, he at once became enlightened. But he further asked, apart from those esoteric sayings and esoteric ideas handed down by the patriarch from generation to generation, are there any other esoteric teachings? Everyone wants to know. I've got something very special, you see. I remember very well one of my contemporaries at Cambridge who gave a lecture many, many years after both of us had left Cambridge, to which I went to that lecture, and he had taken to journalism. And at that lecture, to a very distinguished audience, he said he had had secret information now, you see, etc., which he gave out. And some of those old stagers who were present in the lecture, after it was over, gently put him in his place about secret information. "What I can tell you," answered Huineng, "what I can tell you is not esoteric. If you turn your light inwardly, you will find what is esoteric within you. The truly esoteric is the not yet expressed, not yet formulated, therefore made deathful, fossilized, an excrescence. That is the esoteric. The truly esoteric is continuously a creative power inside you. You look at the whole life of the Buddha after the Enlightenment. The whole life of the Buddha. There is this extraordinary, unceasing creative activity going on. Throughout the discourses, throughout his teaching, whether it comes in Theravada or Mahayana or any other place, you see, whatever the situation may have been, when he suddenly says, bhikkhus, and the monks answer, revered sir, yes sir, like we would say at school, you see, revered sir, and the Buddha says, I will teach you Dhamma. You and I, reading those discourses, studying them carefully, will see how time and again it is the same set of basic statements, with variations as and where required, either by the persons concerned or demanded by the situation. I will teach you Dhamma. Do you think that he merely repeated the same, gave out the same information over and over again? Not a bit of it. He may have used the identical phraseology, but it was a new creation, a transmission out of this living being who was completely in tune with the utmost, reality. One of the finest examples of that occurs when Ananda one day, he must have been in a really clear-minded, exalted mood, and he says, how wonderful is the Paticca-samuppada, how wonderful. Deep it is, O Lord, and wonderful it is. Ah, say not so, Ananda, say not so, says the Buddha. And then the Buddha proceeds to say exactly what he had repeated before in the identical terms that Ananda himself would have said it. Now, let me give you an analogy. You go to a great concert pianist to learn, and you are in absolutely fine fettle, fine form, and you play the particular piece for him, you see, and say, oh, isn't it a marvelous work and beautiful composition and so on. And the master looks at you, this happened to me, sir. And the master looks at you and says, yes, yes, it is a wonderful work, isn't it? Yes. And then he sat down and played it. And, oh my God, the transcendent wonder of it compared with the shoddy wonder of my place. It's like that. So, turn the light inwardly. And when the light is turned inwardly, and it'll turn by itself if you're quiet, that is all. The circumstance has to be the right circumstance, the situation, and you never know whether it is or it is not. That is why the practice of mindfulness enables you to keep you awake and alert. The mind is alert, beautifully tuned, like a Stradivarius, well tuned for the performance. And then suddenly that light turns inwardly, and there is vision, which is not vision of something outside you at a distance, but it is right in here. As I think Kacchana the Great, Mahakacchana said, the Lord has become knowledge. In this case, knowledge, vidya, vidya. Really, the first meaning is vision. Remember, I explained it, the root is vid, to see. He has become vision. And it happens again and again. And you and I, reading or hearing that it happens again and again, think of it as a repetition. It is not a repetition. It is a new creation. Every time it is a new creation. Although the form in which it is apparent to our senses and our logical discursive thought processes may appear to be a repetition of a previous form. It isn't. In the actual living moment, there is new creation, absolutely new creation. This is the experiencing of immortality. You don't have to strive for a prefigured nirvana or a preconceived liberation. The unliberated one cannot conceive, that is, conceive in the sense of make a thought form of liberation. The free state, the state of freedom, is one which is not, does not lie in the context of the known. It lies in the context of the unknown. And when there is actual liberation, and you live in that state of liberation, it never gets translated by concept and word into the realm of the known, into an idea. See? So, that's how you find what is esoteric within you. Let us go on just now to the end of this first chapter, introductory chapter, which is Huineng's autobiography. The most remarkable autobiography. He says, this teaching was handed down from the past patriarchs, and it is not a system of my own invention. Handed down by the patriarchs. The Buddha says that he is merely teaching the same truth that the previous Buddhas taught. In Jainism, you get Mahavira saying the same thing. The previous 24 Tirthankars taught the same teaching, and so forth. They are all called the victorious ones. But whilst this kind of language is used, remember it is misleading language, the reality is quite different. Every time he who, through whom realization has flowered, gives out the truth, communicates the truth, his statement of it, his affirmation of it, is always outstandingly original. It's never the same. Outstanding originality of presentation marks, is one of the high water marks of all the great teachers. They are not copyists. They are not rubber stamp specimens. This is very, very important to bear in mind. That is why those of us who, out of good faith, admittedly, out of sincerity, good-heartedness, but not clear seeing, say that I'm trying to follow in the footsteps of the Master. No, the Master's footsteps leave no track behind. Do remember that. You make your own footprints as you walk. And as and when you are the perfected Holy One, those footprints vanish at once. You are so much not a burden upon Mother Earth that there is no footprint left by a gross you or I. Now, the most important sentence. Those who wish to hear the teaching should first purify their own mind. The sealers, straightway. Those who wish to hear the teaching should first purify their own mind. Otherwise, hearing the words is just water off a duck's back. And after hearing it, they should each clear up their own doubts in the same way as the sages did in the past. Should clear up their own doubts. It is true that Hui Neng puts it as one thing after the other. In actuality, the two go together. With the purification of the mind, the doubts dissolve. The doubts which are opaque obstructions in the way of clear vision, they dissolve. The opaqueness disappears and there is light instead. This goes with the purification of the mind.